The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Monday, December 27th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report.
I thought it was the wrong one, but that's my bad.
We are broadcasting live to tape.
Sorry.
That's all right. Emma's having a little bit of a nervous breakdown. She's like, what do we do? This is one of the things that gets really confusing for people when we do our best ofs, our famous best of shows at the end of the year. We're moving through time and space.
Yeah.
Like, as my son Saul has said, an elevator is like a teleporter. It just takes a little bit more time. Like, all of a sudden, we're on the first floor, then we're on the third floor.
Yeah.
It just takes a little time. We're just in, and we talk about how we need to close that gap, and then it's a real teleporter.
Does he wish that, like, he could apparate, like in Harry Potter? That used to be a real, real big fantasy of mine.
No, that's funny. He's never said that, actually. But what he does like to do is part of, like, you know, one of the, like, stress reducers that I've tried with him this year. Because the kids, you know, they go to school. They have no control over anything because everything's so effed up. Is that I allow him. We went to the Harry Potter store. And we got a wand. And I allow him to do one stupefy a night.
Oh.
Before he goes to sleep.
So do you fall down when you're stupefied?
No, I'm on my bed. I'm reading him a book. We sort of share a room. Sort of roomies. Because I only have, like, I have a two-bedroom apartment, you know.
It's a flex.
It's not really a flex.
Oh.
We sort of made it into a flexy type of thing. And we put, like, a, you know, like a bookshelf in between our, because Mila is older. She needed room. This is too many details. Anyways, I'm on my bed reading him a book before he goes to bed, and he does stupefy, and then I freeze. And then what he likes to do is he likes to take my hand and stick my finger out and stick it up my nose and then just laugh and then unstupefy me. And then
that's what Harry does in the Order of the Phoenix.
Is that what he does?
I must say, Saul is inaccurate because the stupefy actually is a stun spell. It means it's a way to hurt the opponent in a certain way, knock them down. If he's freezing you, that's Petrificus Totalis. And so maybe he should, you know, I don't know, read up on the efficacy of certain spells.
This is the final show that we're going to be doing. We're rolling up the Majority Report now. I cannot believe what that is. I just got stupefied.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not proud of that, but I had to correct the record.
I may have to have you, like, you know, have FaceTime with Saul.
Oh, he's just gonna thought you'd be like, I may have to have you committed.
He's just going to say, like, I don't care what she says. You're going to stupefy. I'm going to make you pick your nose. Folks, let's change pace here. Today on the program, best of 2021, an interview I did with Russ Feingold. You weren't there for this. It was a pre-tape, too. I don't know why.
So all the best ofs just don't include me.
Well, it's a little
wonder
weird.
What that means.
It is strange. It is strange. Russ Feingold, one of my favorite senators of all time.
I wasn't here because I was at the wedding.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And we talked about 9/11, but we talked about, he has some things to say about his Senate colleagues who were against the war in Iraq, but went out and then voted for it. We talk a little bit, I don't think we ever got to the filibuster, which is unfortunate, but we do have Adam Gentleson later in the week. Really interesting to get Feingold's perception of things, one of the good guys. And then we have one of the not so great guys. We have two interviews today. David Feldman comes on, and he is bedeviling. Honestly, there's sometimes I just don't understand where he's coming from. This is one of those times where we spoke to him, and he comes on. It's a little bit upsetting. Sometimes he comes on with a real attitude.
Yeah.
And I don't really appreciate it.
We got sweet and then we got salty.
Yep. That's the way it happens with David Feldman. So check out these. We have another great show for you tomorrow as well. Hope that your Christmas was good if you celebrate it. Whatevs.
I hope I get a lot of gift cards so I can save up for big ticket items as opposed to small little trinkets that I will never use, family.
All right. Well, there you go. It's too late, but they've already bought you those gifts. All right. And tomorrow on the show, we've got two great interviews as well. Actually, three. Tomorrow's a big bonus day. So check it out. All right. Enjoy today's Best of 2021. So, folks, one of our sponsors today is GiveWell. What is GiveWell? Well, this time of year in particular, people are looking for charities. It's hard to know a charity that you can trust, and maybe you want one that you think is going to be most effective. GiveWell.org is the place to basically find some of the most data-driven, effective charities there is, dollar for dollar. What happens is GiveWell spends over 20,000 hours each year researching charitable organizations, and they only recommend a few of the highest impact evidence-based charities they've found. Over 50,000 donors have used GiveWell to donate more than $750 million that will save tens of thousands of lives and improve the lives of millions more. The best part, GiveWell, totally free. They publish all of their research and recommendations on their site for free. There is no sign-up required, none of it. They allocate your tax-deductible donation to the charity you choose without taking a cut. We did a thing with Sunset Lake where we raised over $20,000 for GiveDirectly.org. GiveDirectly.org is a charity that gives the money directly to people. And because there's a lot of evidence that people living in extreme poverty, you give them money, they know how to deploy it. I found that charity on GiveWell.org a couple of years ago when GiveWell.org was one of our sponsors back then. And it's great. It's just great to know that somebody else has done the research of this stuff and that you're giving it to a charity that's going to have real effect. And you can read it all right there. They have a list, I think, of top 10 charities, and you can also look at other charities, but they recommend these just because they are so effective. If you've never donated to GiveWell's recommended charities before, you can have your donation matched up to $250.
Wow.
Before the end of the year, as long as matching funds last. So your $250 will be worth $500 to a charity that you choose from that list. To claim your match, go to GiveWell.org and pick podcast and enter the Majority Report with Sam Seder at checkout. And then bingo bango, you make sure that they know that you heard about GiveWell from the Majority Report to get your donation matched. Check it out. We will put a link in our podcast and YouTube description. We are back on the Majority Report. It is a real pleasure to welcome, I think, back, arguably, to the program, the former senator from Wisconsin from 1993 to 2011 and the current president of the American Constitution Society, Russ Feingold. Russ, welcome back to the program. So much appreciate your coming on.
Sam, I will look forward to it. Thanks for inviting me.
Let's talk about, this is going to air on the, we're recording this a couple days early, but this is going to air on the 10th. And the 20-year anniversary of 9/11, you were a sitting senator at that time, had been in office for 7-8 years. I recall in you wrote about that experience in a book. Tell us, I'm just curious. I was in New York at the time, obviously, and it was, we all have our individual experiences, but I imagine as a senator in Washington, that experience is fairly unique. Tell us about what took place on that day.
Yeah, I'd say fairly unique is an understatement. You talk about having this show on September 10th, and I think about the difference 20 years ago between September 10th and September 11th. I mean, it was just completely out of the blue. There was just a feeling about this. There was zero warning, in effect. I mean, sure, there were terrorist attacks and the like, but the idea that this dramatic an event could occur in the seat of our finances and our seat of our government was something that none of us were thinking about or prepared for. And it just changed everything in terms of our perspective, the mood. And it was, you know, there were elements of it where I was proud of the American and our response. And there were many elements that were very disappointing, where things sort of fell apart quickly after a good start, I would say. And this is what I sort of wrote about in my book, how we sort of, in the first few weeks afterwards, seemed to have a decent notion about how to adjust to this. And then things started to really fall apart, especially with the passage of the so-called USA Patriot Act.
Yeah, I want to get into that. I actually just read your statement that you gave on the Senate floor in October of 2001. But tell us the story. You were with your staffers, and you moved, right? I mean, there was tell us about just like sort of just the what happened on that specific day.
Well, I wasn't actually with my staffers, although my apartment, which I still have, is directly across the street from the Hart office building. And you know, so it was about 8:30 in the morning, of course, on the East Coast. And one of my press secretary had me on the line. We were doing an interview. And we had already seen the first plane hit the tower. And then right as the interview was about to start, he said, and we all could see it on TV, the second tower got hit. And, you know, I then suggested that all the staff come out of the Hart building and come to my apartment, which was, you know, just as I say in my book, nobody ever came into my apartment because it wasn't always in the kind of condition that I wanted it to be in. But so they came over, and then all of a sudden, David Korn from the Nation came ramming on the door saying, "You got to get out of here." And I could see out the window that all these little kids were sort of running, like kind of laughing over the Supreme Court grounds. And I thought, that's odd. Why are the police not stopping them from running all over the grounds like this? And of course, it was because they were being evacuated because the plane, Flight 93, was heading our way, heading toward the Capitol. And so then, yes, we were told we had to get away from there. So we all went en masse to another staff member's house, about five blocks away. And that's where we were holed up as this whole thing started to emerge on 9/11. So it was very dramatic. We were also told that the State Department had been hit, which was erroneous, and that there was a fifth plane that was unaccounted for. This is one of the odd little oddities of the day, and that apparently never occurred. But that's sort of a little bit of the mood that morning.
And so you as a senator didn't get any sort of like it doesn't sound like you had any more insight as to what was happening than the general public. I mean, and just to remind people who might be too young, when the first plane hit, the first report of it was that it was a small plane and that right. It was a horrible accident. And then there was like then that narrative started to crumble a little bit, that somebody had seen a bigger wheel. I mean, I remember listening to Howard Stern, actually, and someone had called in and said there was I saw a bigger wheel. And then, of course, once the second tower hit, it suddenly dawned on everyone that this was on purpose. And there was no further information that you as a senator were getting.
It was very hard to get information because, you know, we didn't have the kind of systems we have now. We just had sort of beepers, as they called them,
right,
where they would call us for votes, and they couldn't really even send us a message, a very brief message. One of the funny stories, you know, it's hard to believe there's anything funny from that day, but Congressman Sensenbrenner, who he and I, you know, he's a very conservative Democrat, a Republican from Wisconsin. He somehow got a message to me whether or not he and I should put out a joint press release. And I said to my staff member, "What in the hell are we going to say?" You know, right. Hi, we're here. So there was just this absurdity. And finally, after a couple of hours, a couple of my staff members and I thought, because we were right near there, why don't we go down to the Capitol Police Station, which is, you know, just below the Hart Building, just a couple of blocks below the Capitol. So we went down there, and it turned out there was sort of this rump Congress starting to meet. There were a bunch, like 50 of us. You know, some of the most right-wing members of the House and the moderates like Joe Lieberman. There was just no rhyme or reason. But we got a briefing from this Senate Sergeant at Arms, and he told us there were five planes and started to explain the information. And then the crazy part was some of these congressmen were saying things like, "Well, we got to start making decisions here." Like we were, like the famous, "We were in charge,"
right?
When in fact the leadership had been spirited away to a quote undisclosed location, and they were meeting somewhere else. So we were in on and off in the Capitol Police building. I remember being with Senator Boxer there, Senator Landrieu, and others. Most of the day until there was sort of a conference call with Senator Daschle, the majority leader and the minority leader, where, you know, sort of some of the ideas about when we would meet the next day and so on were coming together. But it was a long, very strange day.
All right. Well, let's talk about the Patriot Act and sort of like where things began to go off the rails to some extent in terms of in terms of our response. I mean, George Bush initially was pretty adamant about not blaming Islam and Muslims. His initial response was, there was also a lot of, you know, jingoism and, a lot of, you know, sort of, I think the country was largely in shock at this point. And they wanted, and you made this point quite clear in your statement in October of 2001, October 25th, I think it was, they wanted to push the Patriot Act through. I think it was about 10 days. It was probably, I think, like they introduced it on the September 19th, maybe it was, and they wanted it ratified September 21st. And this was a massive overhaul. Talk about what was in there that really struck you at first as very dangerous.
Well, Sam, that was a very accurate portrayal of sort of the progression. In fact, you know, we were able, under the leadership of people like Joe Biden, to really narrow the authorization for the use of military force, which has, of course, been abused ever since. But the original draft we got from the Bush administration was very broad. It would have allowed complete, you know, without any question at all, action against any, quote, terrorist organization without identifying. So those first few days, I felt there was a spirit of bipartisanship. I actually thought George Bush's first speech just after 9/11 was about the best speech I'd ever heard a president give in person. And so in terms of when things started to go off the rails, it was when an expected bill started coming down the pike. And that was a bill that would, quote, update law enforcement authorities. It was later named the USA Patriot Act. But what happened was, said on CNN on Crossfire by conservatives, was that an old wish list of the FBI was dusted off and thrown into the bill. It's one of these must-pass pieces of legislation because just about everybody was afraid of voting against anything was going after the terrorists. And as I've tried to point out many times, maybe 90% of the provisions of the bill were fine or made sense. For example, if you had a legitimate ability to get to wiretap somebody, you could get the conversation, the live conversation, but you couldn't get the voicemails. That didn't make any sense. There wasn't a very long statute of limitations for bioterror. So that made sense. But then what we found, and here the ACLU came to me, I was chairman of the Constitution Subcommittee, and I took the unusual step of actually reading the bill. And I was able to see in 10 or 15 places where things that were really not clearly connected with terrorism had been shoved in the bill, such as this unlimited authority to go after people's, quote, business records, which means library records, healthcare records, without any proof that somebody had done anything wrong at all. And so I instead of sort of saying, look, shouldn't have this bill, I was expecting to vote for the legislation. Then I found this power play was going on. And actually, the House was doing their job. Here, the Republicans and the Democrats on the Judiciary Committee were making a modified version, trying to clean it up like we did with the authorization for the use of military force. And all of a sudden, the process was shut down by the Democratic majority in the Senate. That's what you have to remember. It was the Democrats were in the majority.
Right.
But there was such fear of the Republicans exploiting this, which, of course, they did every chance they got, that they keeled over. And Senator Daschle became very upset with me because I was not giving unanimous consent to moving forward with the bill without amendments. So in the end, I was allowed this very limited period of time to offer a few amendments. And he got up and asked that everybody not vote on the merits. Well, there were actually Republicans who were supporting some of my amendments. Fred Thompson and Arlen Specter, as well as Maria Cantwell, a Democrat who was just new to the Senate. And yet the process was shut down in the hands of Democrats and, of course, Republicans. And as a result, we ended up with a very poor piece of legislation that continues to haunt us today, that was not properly vetted. And it could have been vetted. In fact, many of those provisions that I just mentioned were, in fact, not used for anything to do with terrorism for a long time. They were used in domestic drug cases and other situations like that.
Was there no talk of sunsetting any of those?
Some of them were. So that was one of the few things that we got. For example, this sort of Section 215, it was sunset for about 5 years. So, but most of it was not. And then, of course, the sunsets were renewed, although there was some modification a couple of years ago. It, by and large, the sunsets didn't work. But there, Senator Leahy, who was chairman of the Judiciary Committee at the time, did get a couple of sunsets in there, but most of it was not.
And were you ultimately the only vote against the USA Patriot Act?
I was. I was the only senator to vote against it. And when Bernie Sanders ran for the Senate, when I went up to Vermont to campaign with him, I said, make Bernie the second senator that voted against the Patriot Act, because he voted against it in the House. There were maybe 50 members voted against it in the House. But in the Senate, I didn't realize I would be, but I ended up being the only one. Shortly after, though, a number of senators, people like Dick Durbin on my side, John Sununu of New Hampshire, and Lisa Murkowski on the Republican side, said, you know, we're not sure this was the right thing to do. And we've created a coalition of about six senators. And for years, we raised this issue and even stopped it at one point briefly in 2005, at the end of 2005. And almost our goal was not to kill the entire act, but we were trying to force changes. But it became a real cause celebre in some of the most conservative states in the country, and continues to be, in places like Idaho and Montana and Wyoming, where people were worried about big government intruding on their personal lives.
You raised the Democrats had the majority in the Senate, and I think that lasted until the 2004 election, if I remember.
2002,
they lost it.
Which, by the way, is what this is all about. They figured out how to exploit this terrorism thing, and going after Max Cleland, saying he wasn't patriotic because he voted against the Department of Homeland Security. But before long, Iraq and the Department of Homeland Security and these things were used to get back the majority. And this led a number of Democratic senators who were running for president to vote for the Iraq war against their own best instincts, which was a terrible moment.
I mean, all of this is coming rushing back, and it's really, it's disturbing. Nightmare. I mean, I remember Max Cleland, and we should tell people he was a vet who had lost multiple limbs in Vietnam. And there was, if I remember correctly, they made an ad of him morphing into Osama bin Laden because of his votes. And people should understand that the Department of Homeland Security, only 20 years old. I mean, when we talk about things like ICE, it came from it. These things of these fusion centers. I mean, all of this are, were innovations, I guess, at that time. Was that essentially it? There was so much fear amongst Democrats in terms of like elected Democrats, the specter of, it seemed to me, of Vietnam, Bill Clinton was elected as sort of like the post-Vietnam era, but it still feels like the idea of peaceniks or weak on defense or whatnot, that specter dictated everything the Democrats did in that moment, it feels like.
Yeah, it came roaring back, and until Iraq went really badly, and it was a catastrophe, really, for Bush by 2006. At that point, the politics of it shifted. But in terms of the moment where I really realized that this was going to be exploited, I mentioned a minute ago, Sam, that the first speech by Bush was really quite a good speech. The second one was scary. That's where he introduced the idea of the axis of evil. All of a sudden, this guy, just a few weeks after 9/11, is talking about Iraq and North Korea and Iran with zero evidence of any connection of any of them to 9/11. And all of a sudden, you realize that Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, all these guys had figured out what you just said. The Democrats weren't going to stand in the way of anything if you labeled it terrorism. And so, sure enough, they went for it. They exploited the authorization for the use of military force. They started doing illegal wiretapping and eavesdropping outside of the statutes. They started doing torture. They exploited the Department of Homeland Security issue. And, of course, they took us into war in Iraq, saying that completely falsely that, A, this was something to do with Al-Qaeda, and B, that there were weapons of mass destruction ready to be used and that could be used against us. So by the time you get to the 2004 presidential election, people are still pretty cowed. And Bush manages to win again, in spite of the fact that that war was already not going very well.
What was the sense amongst your colleagues? I mean, were you blindsided by the reluctance? I mean, what does it feel like when, I mean, because I think, you know, and we should talk a little bit about, you know, what parts of the Patriot Act still in many respects haunt us. But, you know, you offered a list of things from the manipulations involved in going into Iraq and the lies involved in going into Iraq, the torture regime that the Senate ultimately, I guess maybe, you know, 5 or 6 years later, starts to do a report on. And at one point they're spied on by the CIA, you know, as they're actually doing this report. I mean, what was the sense of your colleagues? I mean, I have no idea of, like, you know, what kind of conversations you have with other senators, but were you, like, what did they express? Was it just sort of, we're beleaguered, we can't do anything about it, you're right, there's a problem? Or was it, you know, look, that's not what this is about? I mean, what was that dynamic like?
Well, it began, and it's understandable in a way for all of us, including me, is that I kept thinking of this famous phrase from law school: the Constitution is not a suicide pact. And, you know, I put that in my first speech on 9/11, and I realized that, of course, it's not a suicide pact. But if you look at where that came from, it was in a decision by Justice Goldberg, where he actually stood up on the side of civil liberties, saying that, yes, the Constitution is not a suicide pact. But when the founders made the Constitution, they were not exactly on easy street themselves. They were really in risk of all being hanged. And so, you know, you start off with this idea, well, this is so unusual that we're going to have to not really follow the Constitution, or you know, we're going to have to let the administration do what it wants, sort of a unitary executive kind of view. Very gradually, as the politics of this shifted, as very conservative states began to have constituencies saying, you know, slow down here, what are you doing? Then some of the Democratic senators started to get a little more interested in trying to put the brakes on this. And then, of course, as the Iraq war started not going so well, after the initial notion that somehow we were going to, by Rumsfeld, that we were going to be showered with flowers by the people as we came there, people became a little more emboldened and started to question the Iraq war, even those who hadn't voted against it. Unfortunately, a majority of the Democrats in that caucus, we were in the majority when we voted for the Iraq war, and a majority of the members, by one or two, voted for the Iraq war. And, you know, one of the main reasons that Barack Obama became president, in addition to his great personal qualities, is that he's the only one that had any kind of credible claim that he had said something against the war.
Right. There was a video of him.
Didn't have that. Clinton didn't have that, you know. And so what we ended up with was a situation where suddenly people wanted to be on that side of it. And I remember when I was proposing amendments relating to getting us out of Iraq, I was the first senator to propose a timetable to get us out of Iraq, as well as amendments about the Patriot Act. I would always see Hillary Clinton and Obama looking at each other to see how they were going to vote on my amendment, because at that point, they wanted to be associated with a more progressive questioning mode because of the primaries. They knew that the left and progressives in the key states like Iowa and New Hampshire and others were going to be looking to those that had credentials that challenged
right
some aspects of 9/11.
And so, I mean, I don't want to press too hard. Obviously, I don't want any names, but I'm curious as to, like, you know, I mean, you're not talking about, you know, when you're talking about your problems with the Iraq war, you know, in the moment, and the Patriot Act in the moment, you're subjected to the exact same pressures, theoretically, as everyone, you know, the other senators there. I mean, were they articulating a sense of, like, politically, I just can't do this? And I agree with you, or was it, I mean, was there a mix? I mean, what was the range, you know, without, I understand, you know, you don't necessarily have to give names, but I'm curious about this dynamic, because I think this is, you know, the U.S. Senate, I think people are even more conscious of it now, is an incredibly non-democratic institution in the context of a democracy. And certainly, you know, as you go forward through the years from that time, you could see there were senators who decided, like, you know what, we're not going to lower the age of Medicare to 55 because I don't want to. I'll say his name, Joe Lieberman. But so there are people, and it's not inconceivable that it was just because there was somebody on a blog who, you know, who said something mean about me, and that's it. I'm not going to do. I mean, but I. So it's hard, I think, for people sort of on the outside to sort of say, like, how is it that you were able to look at this? And what were the reasons why other senators, who I imagine there were some, at least, who had some sensitivity to this? Was it just purely, like, from a political standpoint, if I don't do this, I'm not back here in 2003?
Yeah, I think probably first of all, I would say 20 years later, and certainly even 10 years after, it was fine to name names. You know, history is more important than protecting people's feelings at this point. And so what I can tell you is that people would have said to me at the time, well, you know, you're not up for re-election until 2004, and you come from a different kind of state, et cetera, you're not running for president. But, you know, the truth is that I heard every one of those presidential candidates get up in closed caucus and say, this is not a good idea. We should not be going into this war. And then the political pitch was made by the leader and others saying, what will we be able to do to stop what they're doing if we lose the majority?
Right.
You know, so that became the pitch, this sort of, quote, pragmatic pitch. And then you have this tragedy of good people. And they are good people. Some of them people that were very appropriate presidential candidates who managed to accept that notion and out of political fear, after saying those words in close caucus, walked out to the floor and voted for this war that sent so many of our people to their doom in Iraq. And that was, to me, was one of the saddest things I had ever seen in politics, that somebody would do this. The guy that really had a terrible time was Paul Wellstone. He was writhing over this. He was saying, I understand the argument that we need to vote for it. You know, he was having a very hard time. He got in front of the caucus and he thought he would lose his reelection if he voted against the war. In the end, he did vote against the war. And the last time I ever saw Paul was I was coming to the Senate chamber and he was leaving the Senate chamber a few days before he was killed in a plane crash. And I said, Paul, you're up by 9 points in the polls. You're going to win. And he got this big smile on his face, like he knew he'd done the right thing and he was going to win. And that's the last time I ever saw him. He had done the right thing.
And I want to talk about some of the lessons that clearly weren't learned in many respects. But when you look back at the Patriot Act, or, I mean, obviously, we just literally finished a 20-year war in Afghanistan. You know, what we did in Iraq is going to resonate for generations and generations. When you look back in the wake of 9/11, in terms of, like, the most, problematic, things that were done by our government, and the legacy that they will have. I mean, I guess the question is, on some level, like, there's stuff that we can't put the toothpaste back into the tube, as it were, on a lot of these things. What are those things that are the most sort of toxic, I guess, toothpaste that's out of those tubes?
Well, you know, one of them would be, of course, this idea of military authority on the part of the president that's completely unlimited. This idea that Article 2 of the Constitution allows the president to do whatever he wants, and that the idea that Congress is supposed to declare war is sort of a dead letter. That has gotten worse and worse throughout the 20th century and the first part of the 21st century. And this made it even worse with John Yoo over at the Office of Legal Counsel writing opinions that really had no basis in constitutional law. So this was a very bad period for this, where Congress was very docile, did not stand up for its authorities under the Constitution, under Article 1, to be involved in decisions about whether to go to war, whether to get out of a war. Only now, recently, are some groups of bipartisan senators led by people like Tim Kaine in Virginia trying to come together and reassert congressional authority in this area. They are talking about undoing the authorization for the use of military force vis-a-vis Iraq and making some progress, less so with regard to the Afghanistan authority, which needs to be repealed. And then the same thing goes for the Patriot Act, where they made some changes a couple of years ago. They were able to get a couple of things modified, but basically those authorities for the government to simply go to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which is a secret court, and ask to see personal records of people really haven't been changed. And so these legacies continue. And Sam, I would say there's two things going on. One is, whenever you have a crisis, there's going to be some overreaction. It doesn't make it right. You have to guard against it. And mistakes have been made in that regard. For example, the famous internment of Japanese Americans, the Korematsu case. That's one thing. The second thing, though, that is even more sinister is the conscious decision to exploit the moment, to exploit the opportunity to get something else, to get more cracking down on people's civil liberties. And that's the danger post January 6th. I wrote a piece for the Wall Street Journal that said, look, we have to have accountability for these people that did this thing on January 6th, 2021. But let's not create authorities that are used against Black Lives Matter and people that are protesting the pipeline. Which is what has happened too often. So this is a moment of vigilance, because people will take this opportunity cynically to further restrict people's freedoms, further enhance executive power over the power of Congress.
And even if they're not aware that they're doing it, right? I mean, you're setting up an apparatus that in many instances, you know, you never know who could be the next president. No. It could be Donald Trump.
I think we have enough lessons, like what was done using the Department of Homeland Security by Trump and Portland and others, to see that there are plenty of people who are doing it consciously, as well as people that are doing it in good faith. But really, there is a way to be more careful about this and the way these things are written and interpreted.
What was your sense of the Obama presidency in terms of some of these things? I mean, during the Obama presidency, I mean, you mentioned John Yoo, who was in the Office of Legal Counsel, wrote many of the documents that basically argued for the authority for the president to do all sorts of things, you know, from torture to other unilateral measures. During the Obama years, we had things like the establishment sort of like bringing in from the cold, almost, the legal authority to assassinate American citizens. We have Anwar al-Awlaki as one. I think there were others. There was a Tuesday meeting when they were looking at targets. We still have a secretive no-fly list that exists, that persists. The torture was never... We have laws on the books that outlaw torture, but we never reiterated those laws. It was sort of banished by executive authority or order, as opposed to sort of being ensconced in with some type of legal authority. We had very little accountability for anything that happened during the Bush years. I mean, what in the Obama years, what did that do to the trajectory of where we were at that point?
Well, it was a very mixed picture, and you know, frankly, disappointing. And let me say that I think President Obama was a marvelous president in many ways. But this was an area that was disappointing. I, as chairman of the Constitution Subcommittee in the fall before the election in 2008, held a hearing where we identified like 26 areas where civil liberties problems had to be fixed by whoever the new president would be. And I thought, based on his votes and his role in support of my work and others in the Senate, that he was going to be very strong on this. He was strong on trying to get rid of Guantanamo, but Congress screwed that up. That was not his fault, but he tried. He was, I would say, fairly strong on the torture issue. But on many other issues, I'm afraid he was convinced by the CIA and by the military to buy a number of arguments that, you know, frankly, because of his inexperience, he was deferential in a way that actually Joe Biden was not as much. Joe Biden, even though people are, he's having a heck of a time now, he was the one challenging the further growth of the Afghanistan invasion, because he wasn't accepting the lines of the military that he had heard many times before in his decades in the Senate. So his experience there is something that led him to be a little more cautionary. So I would say that an opportunity to fix many of these things was missed. Some things were fixed. Certainly, in most regards, he didn't make things worse. But you're right. The killing of the people in Yemen was one of those examples of something that I was pretty astonished by, that the American citizens, where there was no real due process, no judge was involved at all, or could have been. So I remember being very concerned about that. So, yes, it was an opportunity missed in some respects.
You mentioned Biden's reluctance, and he's taken us out of Afghanistan. And I think there was one gets the sense that there was a tremendous amount of resistance to that in foreign policy and defense circles and whatnot. Yet, as we leave, we launch a drone attack that appears to have killed nearly 10 children, at least. Half a dozen more citizens, maybe a little bit more than that. There is a sense that we're incapable of learning any lessons from this, even if we are generous, I think, with the motivations.
That's right. Well, you know, it's funny because a couple of Republicans are ones that created some of the best phrases about this that we didn't learn from. Colin Powell famously said, "You break it, it's yours." You know, basically with regard to invasions, and that's one example. Another one was Bob Dole talking about mission creep in Somalia. Well, this is what happened here. I voted for the Afghanistan war because I wanted us to go get Bin Laden and get out. And even though I voted for it, I was the first senator to propose us getting out of Afghanistan as early as 2008. I proposed a withdrawal timeline just as I had done with Iraq, because I felt that it would never change. Exactly what Biden said, only it was 13 years later.
Right.
And all these things and trying to sort of micromanage a situation like this with drones, that will never work. And that's what you get yourself into when you try to, you know, due to nation building in a place where we simply can't do that without too much terrible sacrifice of American life and American resources. So it's a very painful thing, and we waited way too long, and it's much worse because we waited this long.
I want to turn a little bit to sort of politics more generally since 2001. You were a senator from 93 to 2011. You crossed that divide, and on some level, I also think that the election of 2000, in many respects, I mean, you're someone obviously a member of the judiciary. You sat on the Constitution Committee. I would imagine, were quite surprised by the Supreme Court even looking at the Bush v. Gore case, aside from their ruling it. But how much has 9/11, or how much has, over the course of those 30 years, our politics changed? I mean, I know, like, I remember when you were a sitting senator, you were very much an institutionalist. Yeah, I remember being frustrated by your insistence on voting for a president's nominees and that type of deference. I was very frustrated by that. But it was a principled stand that you had. And I think to a certain extent, your perspective has changed on that, but more so because things have changed in the context. I mean, talk about that change and what you attribute that to.
Yeah, I tried to take a view that the Senate as an institution was a place where people could work together and should work together, and party does not come first. And in many ways, it was like that when I got there in 1992 for a number of years. It was not all blood and guts and trying to upend the other. And, you know, the votes you remember are situations that generally I voted, of course, pretty far left with regard to nominations. But, you know, basically things that would involve norms, such as allowing the president to pick his own cabinet. I mean, the example I used when I voted for John Ashcraft for attorney general was, look, if we had a different president, he appointed Paul Wellstone as secretary of labor, you might not like it, but he gets to choose this person unless that person has got an ethical problem or is unqualified. So to me, that was a norm that should be respected. The same thing was my view when it came to Supreme Court nominations, that you could be pragmatic to a degree. But basically, the president is going to get this choice usually. So when it came to John Roberts, I thought, this guy is certainly not my cup of tea. This guy is way too conservative for me, but I think he's going to care about the court as an institution. So I voted for him, but I voted against Samuel Alito because I could tell there was no flexibility there. His concern was ideology. I looked at all the cases where there had been corporations involved in a case. He never voted against a corporation on behalf of the little guy. So I didn't feel that people would have a chance. So to me, making principal distinctions between nominees, not based on party or ideology, but based on the fact that the president basically gets to have this choice unless there's something wrong, was a philosophy I had. Now, that's changed, as you've said, because now what they've adopted is a purely partisan attempt. And this is what our American Constitution Society is all about. I'm president of the American Constitution Society. And we are trying to respond to what is essentially the theft of the United States Supreme Court after the Scalia death and the Ginsburg death. And we are trying to make it clear to people that what has happened with the Federalist Society and the Trump administration and others is that we have an outrageously white, male, very young judiciary that does not reflect the American people and does not reflect the society we live in. And so we are working very hard with success to get the Biden administration to start reversing this because they did great damage to it. And so, you know, that is not something I ever would have expected to need to do, because I never would have thought that there would be that disrespect in the Senate for the traditions of bipartisanship, letting President Obama have his nominees, of course, letting President Obama have Merrick Garland confirmed for the Supreme Court. Once they smash all those, at that point, you have to say, wait a minute, there has to be reparations, there has to be recompense. Maybe someday we can get back to some sense of comedy, but it doesn't exist now. And so our organization is eager to look at things like expanding the size of the Supreme Court, possibly having term limits. Something has to happen because they have stolen the court. And now you have an increasingly less legitimate institution that is deciding things almost every day. Wait till we get this abortion decision.
Yeah,
this
we should say. I was just going to say, I mean, in that regard, and I should also note that it's gone largely unreported, but Biden is at the very least been very aggressive in filling federal judiciary seats, and has done so with a diversity that we haven't really seen.
That is
in a couple of decades. And by diversity, I'm not talking just from a racial or ethnic or gender background, but I'm talking about fields of the law, which have been underrepresented in our judiciary for years. We're not just getting corporate lawyers.
Yeah, President Biden has been terrific on this. And frankly, this is what we do. Our organization has 53 working groups across the country that have produced the names of people who are diverse in both respects, just as you said. Of course, African-Americans, Latina, Latinx people, LGBTQ plus people, but also people that have worked for unions, people that have been public defenders, people who have represented criminal defendants. And this is actually happening. So this is becoming more and more reported. It needs to be reported more because this is a big success story, frankly, compared to the previous two Democratic administrations. This is an outstanding beginning, and we are very pleased to be working on this on a daily basis.
I think there was a heightened awareness of the failure of the Obama administration to fill these seats and the implications of it. And you mentioned we are recording there. As far as I know, we're recording in the afternoon of the 31st. If the Supreme Court does not enjoin Texas from its law that basically empowers citizens to sue abortion providers, there's an argument that Roe v. Wade has been effectively rolled back in Texas. Let me ask you, like, what is the most disturbing trend that you're seeing on the Supreme Court in terms of that? You know, there's been a number of decisions made through the shadow docket just in the past week or two. The Remain in Mexico. The second one was the eviction moratorium. There's been others. I mean, in the shadow docket, we should tell people, is just sort of the Supreme Court using its emergency powers to, I guess, what is equivalent to like a summary judgment without having to issue any type of decision. Without having to justify the decision in any way, so that we can examine it and so that people have a sense of what the law is, and without any real accounting for, you know, which justice decided in which way. What else are you seeing, or is that one of the more disturbing aspects that you're seeing in terms of the court?
It's a very disturbing aspect, this shadow docket, and it's very similar to the kinds of things that the executive and the Congress have done, too, which is basically... What you do is, you know, there are certain things you can do, but there's restraint. There are norms. It's not used across the board. Now, shadow docket is being used systematically by the right on the Supreme Court to try to get things done that normally people would want to know about. And so, of course, we've had, you know, opinions or decisions made without opinions many times, but this is a whole nother thing. And so what it is the constant gutting of our institutions and our branches of government by the exploitation of what are often somewhat hidden rules. I mean, people see the filibuster. They become more aware of that. They weren't aware of it for a long time and aware of how brutal it has become. It wasn't used like Jimmy Stewart anymore. It's being used, you know, as something that is just done to try to kill basically all legislation you don't like. That was not the way it was used when I came to the Senate in 1992. So These are things that are being done to systematically exploit institutions for the right wing agenda in this country. And this shadow docket is an example of this on the Supreme Court. So they may look moderate at times. You know, there's these decisions such as the Maui decision about the Clean Water Act and others where, you know, it's not the usual lineup, but they're getting an awful lot done behind the scenes. They're also making a lot of decisions that are maybe less big ticket items, trying to look reasonable, trying to look moderate, and setting the stage for something that could be just outrageous, such as the Roe v. Wade issue.
Well, former Senator Russ Feingold, current president of the American Constitution Society, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Well, I hope people will go to acslaw.org and consider donating to the organization. And also, please check our new ACS podcast that we really are proud of. We've named it Broken Law, so you get an idea of what that's all about, all the way from the death penalty to issues of truth, race, and race reconciliation. Sam, pleasure to be on.
Well, we'll put links to both those in our podcast and YouTube description today. Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Hold on, because we're going to be talking to David Feldman, I believe, in just a second. Folks, of course, know David Feldman. He is a host of the David Feldman program. David, are you there?
Can you drip with more sarcasm?
I'm sorry. Could you say that again? I had you drop down.
I was just wondering if you could drip with more sarcasm in that introduction.
I was not being sarcastic. I'm sorry. You took it that way. I'm here with Emma Vigeland, who I'm sure, you know, will have a tone that you'll appreciate more than me.
I like Emma.
Oh. Hi, David Feldman.
See, she meant that. I could tell she was. I could tell that she was happy that I'm coming on the show and that I'm not like this last. Like you called everybody, and I was last on your list. Like I can tell she's excited to talk with me, Sam.
I'm excited to talk to you about it.
I mean, David, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, because I know there's a big, big component of this in LA, is the Medicare for All march this weekend. I want to get your sense of, you know, what you think about that march happening now. You know, I don't know that it's particularly controversial that it's happening now, but
I think it's a little too soon. It reminds me of force the vote. I don't think it's smart to start marching right now.
How is it like force the vote? Like, why is it too soon?
It's children. It's people who don't understand how things get done in Washington. And just, you know, a march for Medicare for All. So they have this big march, right? And then Monday, Nancy Pelosi doesn't introduce Medicare for All in Congress. Then we blew it. Then we'll never, you know, it's like you wait your turn before you have a march for Medicare for All. What happens? They have the big march and then it doesn't get voted on Monday. Then the whole thing, then we're never going to have Medicare for All. It's just amateur. It's amateur hour.
Isn't the march about getting, getting more people involved in a movement to push for it? Like, presenting the idea that there's going to be a lot of people who want Medicare for All?
Yeah, well, this is what happens when you have inexperienced people who don't know how things get done. And, you know, I want Medicare for All more than anybody. You know that, right?
Yes, no, of course. I know that. Sure.
Yeah. I'd like to know how we're going to pay for it, but I want Medicare for All.
Taxation.
Like I said, I'd like to know how we're going to pay for it. I think the march, an entire nationwide march telling the world that we want Medicare for All is so stupid, so childish. It's not how you get things done. Can I talk about something that's a little more important to me?
Sure.
Do you mind?
No.
Well, I was reading Michael's piece in Jacobin, Michael Brooks.
Yes.
His piece in Jacobin. And you know about the Michael Brooks Legacy Project, right?
Yes. You and I.
It's creating work. Hello?
Yes. Go ahead.
It's creating work that continues his legacy. And if you go to patreon.com/TMBS, you can donate money.
Correct.
To the. Yeah. So, you know, when I donate, it's between me and my God. You know that, right?
I do.
I don't donate to get my name on a plaque, unlike you and your family. I remember growing up, every time your father donated, we had to hear about it. I think that's disgusting.
David, you and I, frankly, did not grow up together.
Okay. Well, all I remember is your mother and father, if they donated to any cause, we had to hear about it in the car on the way to camp. What? I give money. I was raised differently from you. I was raised when you give money, you do it because it's the right thing to do. You give anonymously. Okay. And that's what I decided to do. I decided to give a donation to the Michael Brooks Legacy Project.
Yeah, you, David Feldman, right? It's not anonymous now that you've said it, David.
No, I'm not telling anybody that I donate. I went to patreon.com/TMBS. And when I donated, they asked if, you know, but they wanted, if they could put my name on a list. And, you know, I gave a lot. I gave a lot of money.
Wait a second.
David. A lot.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. But, I mean, you realize you're telling us makes it not anonymous.
No, no, no. They asked me at patreon.com/TMBS. They said, do you want to be put on a list of people who gave? And
David, you understand, but the point is, though, is that you're making, in addition to the fact that you've never met my parents, we never went to the same camp. In fact, we did not know each other until I was, well, at least into my 20s. I don't even know if you knew who I was. I mean, I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
But aside from that,
the trauma was so bad. You've just blocked a lot of things out. The trauma of being in a car with your parents, smoking cigarettes on the way to camp, bragging, oh, we gave money to this, the fire, the Toys for Tots. We gave this much and that much. We're such good people. You were traumatized by how tacky your parents were in just wearing their generosity on their sleeve. They couldn't do one good thing anonymously, unlike my parents, who taught me nobody needs to know that you donated to the Michael Brooks Legacy Project.
You realize
that's not how I was raised. Nobody needs to know how much I put on my credit card. That's not why I donate, Sam. It's not about me. It's about Michael's legacy, okay?
Listen, right now it's as if we're in a car together, except for you're not smoking cigarettes. I mean, the hypothetical, in fact, untrue scenario that you, except for the cigarette smoking, frankly, that you constructed there, that aside, what's happening right now is very much like that. You're sitting here telling, you've just told Emma and I that you donated.
I donated anonymously because it's not about you or Emma saying, hey, what a great guy that David Feldman, who will be appearing in East Orange, New Jersey this week at the Mask Optional Comedy Club, is. I don't need to hear that. I don't need to hear you saying what a great guy. That's not why I donate money to a cause.
David, can I pull you back to something else? I'm curious.
I'm going to be at Mask Optionals. Hang on. I'm going to be at Mask Optionals in East Orange, New Jersey. I probably will not even mention that. If somebody asked me, did you give money? And I gave a lot. To
Michael Brooks, yes, patreon.com / TMBS.
Yeah, I gave a lot.
David, no, yes.
I gave a lot. But at Mask Optionals.
Wait, Mask Optionals is the name of a comedy club?
Yeah, I'm playing Mask Optionals. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I mean, Mask Optionals in East Orange. People are going to probably ask me, did you give to Michael's charity? I'm not, that would be bragging.
Let me ask you this, okay? If we could just turn it back to something in the news.
Let's talk about something else, because that's not why I called, Sam. I there's a march on Medicare for All. We have to get to the bottom of who was behind the insurrection.
Well, let me ask you about that since you raised that insurrection. Kevin McCarthy is basically, has pulled all the members of the Republican Party off the commission because Nancy Pelosi rejected Jim Banks and Jim Jordan. Jim Jordan, more so because they wouldn't validate the election of Joe Biden, rather than Jim Jordan having a problem with, ignoring pleas from the wrestlers who he coached as to their charges that they were being molested. But what is your perspective on that?
I don't need a thank you note from the Michael Brooks Legacy Project. And it doesn't bother me that I accidentally donated more than I intended to. That does not That doesn't bother me. I don't understand.
You accidentally donated more than you intended to?
Did you put an extra zero
on it? A little extra. Thank you. I guess you heard that I accidentally put
You just told us.
Told us what?
All right. Look, what about the...
I told you. What did I tell you?
No, what did I just tell you? January 6th, the commission. Okay. Patreon.com/TMBS for the legacy project. But
January 7th, the worst day in American history in my lifetime. January 7th was... We need to get to the bottom of January 7th.
No, I think you mean...
I will never forget January 7th.
David, I think you mean January 6th. January 6th. That was the day...
I think you are abusive and you don't honor my mental illness. You know I sleep a lot. You know I didn't find out about it until the next day that I've been depressed. You had to bring... Why would you do that? Why would you bring up that I sleep for long stretches of time? And for me, it's January 7th and not January 6th. Why don't you respect?
People generally, pin events to when they happen, not when they find out about them.
When I woke up.
Well, I understand.
So you don't think make calling it January 6th instead of January 7th? How do you think that makes me feel?
I like you've been corrected as to when the specific event happened. I don't know.
You think you're being inclusive by calling it January 6th when I didn't wake up until January 7th that I had been depressed and sleeping for a couple of days? David, how old were you
when you found out about World War II?
I don't know. You have this whole patina of, everybody, let's play with everybody. But people who are suffering from mental illness like me, who have been depressed and been sleeping a lot, because I'm an empath. And this pandemic has hit me harder than most people, and I've been sleeping a lot.
To call it January 6th
instead of January 7th when I first found out about it makes me feel left out.
All right, January 6th and 7th. Would that be better?
Thank you. See? Yes. Or just January 7th.
The event that happened in the first week of January.
How about we just call it January 7th to respect
I think it's going to be confusing
illness.
For other people. That's why.
I think I've had it especially tough the past year and a half. Okay.
Well, I would prefer it
if people honored my pain and called it January 7th.
All right, fine.
And quite frankly, I think you are, insensitive, and, I'm taking to Twitter right now.
Well, wait a second. Before you go to Twitter, let me just, okay.
No, I'm on Twitter. Emma, I'm leaving you out of this. This has nothing to do with you.
Just know that when you take to Twitter, you could ruin Sam's career.
But you know what? I don't know.
I don't care. Okay. So January 7th, what is your perspective on this commission?
We need to get to the bottom of who was behind this.
Okay.
That is how we win big. You got to go big to keep the house in 2022. And, I want a filibuster proof Senate,
Right.
And so the only way you do that is you go big. You go big, like unimaginably big.
Well,
and we should spend the next year. If you want to win, you spend the next year focusing only on the January 7th insurrection. You put that's why the Medicare for All march is childish. It's Bush League. It's they don't know. go
big.
What
about the infrastructure bill? You don't think that's big?
It's not good enough. It's only $3.5 trillion. It's not big enough. Bernie sold us out. Bernie, forget it. I'm not interested. Go big on the insurrection. That's how you defeat the Republicans. You got to put numbers on the board, Sam. The Democrats need to say, look at what we've done for you. Look at what are you going to run on in 2022? A $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill that is painfully short? They came up completely short. Bernie completely sold out the party. There's nothing in
the
that
party?
Infrastructure. There's nothing. So throw it out.
What do you mean there's nothing? There's literally $3.5 trillion.
He abandoned me. Just like, he abandoned me. I'm not interested. Focus on the insurrection. That is what will get the Democrats reelected.
David, don't you think it's going to be confusing for people who would vote for Democrats under your plan when they talk about the January 7th insurrection and people are out there just going, you mean January 6th? Because most of those people, with total respect for your sleeping habits, were awake on that day and they found out about it on that day, on the 6th.
Wow. Wow.
I'm just asking. Wow. I'm asking a question.
Why are you being ableist?
Do you talk to your kids this way?
I mean,
Do you talk to your kids this way? Is that how you treat?
I don't have
people in your personal life?
Really, to be totally honest. Because they're 8 what? And 15. I don't really have to.
Yeah. Are you that cruel to your kids?
I mean, what part of what I'm saying is cruel? I'm just asking you if you don't think it's going to be confusing for people. Like, surely.
I have faith in the American people. I think they're smart enough to see the Democrats going big on the January 7th investigation and they're saying, hey, wait a second, this party cares about me. They're trying to get to the bottom of what happened on January 7th. I think most Americans are smart enough to say, you know what? Infrastructure, Medicare for all, that can wait. I'm looking for a Senate and a House that can put out the hope that in 2023 I might get to see Donald Trump's tax returns. See, that's how you win elections, Sam, by holding out the hope that we could possibly maybe see Donald Trump's tax returns in 2023.
David,
you got to do big things. You got to do big things, Sam.
Maybe let's turn. Maybe it'll be easy. Let's turn to the what's happening.
See, you're with all due respect, you're a fool. You don't understand the American people. With all due respect, no. You don't understand the American people. We do big things. We do big things. Like Richard Branson, the first billionaire into space. Didn't that make you proud to be an American?
Well, first of all, Branson's British. And I don't know if he was the first. Wasn't it Bezos or I don't know?
Richard Branson was the first American billionaire in outer space.
Isn't Branson that made British? Isn't Richard Branson, he's Sir Richard Branson because he was knighted. I think he's British.
Well, Paul McCartney was also knighted. That doesn't make him British.
It didn't make him British, but he was British. Paul McCartney was British.
Is.
Sir Paul, the Beatles.
The Beatles were Liverpool.
You know
England.
What? Let's just, I'll compromise. If you say Richard Branson is the point. Jeff Bezos, okay? Wasn't that great? He went big, Jeff Bezos, right?
Well, I mean, we
that's
went
what
up
the Democrats have to do.
11 minutes, Sam, geez.
11 minutes.
That's right.
So
look how far. That was amazing. Did that make you proud? Look how far we've come, Emma, in 50 years. 52 years ago, we walked on the moon, right?
Right.
It took a week to go to the moon and back. Look at how far we've come in 52 years. We're sending people into space for 12 minutes.
Yeah,
the moon,
David,
took a week. It's that, like Moore's
That technology was around for quite a while. The one that Bezos and Branson kind of used.
I don't think you understand how exponentially the private sector has made brought efficiency into space travel. With all due respect, Sam's a fool, and with all due respect, it took a week to go to the moon and come back. Jeff Bezos went into a suborbital flight and back in 12 minutes. That's like Moore's law. You know how chips get more efficient?
Yeah, no, I know Moore's law. Months? I know Moore's law. Yes. All right, but wait. Let me ask you. Okay, let's turn to the vaccine.
I mean, you think about this. This is why you privatize the space program. A week to go to the moon and back, 52 years ago. That was just like a boondoggle. That was like the big dig in Boston.
Well, I mean, the big dig.
Just a waste of money.
It was expensive, and there was a lot of overruns, but it ended up being pretty good.
Yeah, but Jeff Bezos, he was actually 6 minutes above the Kármán line.
David, I'm getting a little bit frustrated. Talk about
Neil Armstrong, like a week. It was a week. Listen. It took him a week to get to the moon.
David,
understand math?
All right, let's talk math. Let's talk a little bit about vaccination rates. I don't know if you've noticed over the past week, there's been a change in some of the Republican elected leaders. They are now seem to be embracing vaccines for people. What's your take on that?
The Republicans being for vaccines. I'm not a doctor. I don't know if they're safe.
Well, okay.
I'm not a doctor.
Doctors are telling you that it's
safe.
Are
you a doctor?
I'm not a doctor, but I don't know that any medical treatment is safe. And the doctors do, and the doctors say it's safe.
The doctors say it's safe.
Correct.
But I'm not a doctor. So I don't know if it's safe. I think it's individual choice.
All right.
To decide.
Do you take any medications?
Safe.
Have you ever taken any medications? Have you ever had any medical intervention at all?
I'm not a doctor.
No, I'm not asking if you have
medically
intervened.
I don't know.
I'm asking as
a
patient. Have you ever been a patient?
Medical intervention or not?
Have you ever been a patient? Have you ever been a patient?
I don't know because I'm not a doctor. So I don't if I'm in a hospital, I don't know if I'm a patient or a doctor because I these things are beyond me, and I think it requires study. So I don't know. I don't know if I've ever been a patient because I'm not a doctor, nor am I a scientist.
All right.
I don't know. I'm just saying that people should, if you're in a hospital, right?
Yeah.
You should decide. You should decide yourself if you're the patient or the doctor. That should be your decision.
Okay. So,
not Sam, why are you... You're violating David's HIPAA rights here.
I'm sorry?
Well, I mean, why is Sam violating your HIPAA rights by asking all these questions?
Exactly. Thank you, Emma. See? Emma gets it.
Wait a second.
It's nobody's, nobody's business if I've been a patient or a doctor. First off, she's absolutely right. That's the first thing. And it's my choice when I'm feeling a pain in my chest or my lungs are filled with fluid. It's my choice to decide if I'm going to go to the hospital. And it's my choice to shop around to see which hospital is the cheapest. And, you know, if I'm having a heart attack, I'll go to Lenox Hill. How much for a defibrillator? Okay.
That makes you
right
a patient
back.
Though, maybe,
let me go
right?
Uptown to Mount Sinai. I hear it's cheaper. Just hang on.
Yeah.
And you know, you shop around, and then when I get in the hot, when I settle on the price of, you know, the heart valve being replaced, you negotiate.
Of course.
much. Then I decide, am I the patient or am I the doctor? Then I decide. And that's my choice to decide, not yours, Sam, if I'm a patient or a doctor.
If you're
what are you asking me about the vaccines for? I'm not a doctor. People should decide for themselves.
You're not a doctor. I'm asking you. You're not a doctor, so you're a patient.
No, I'm not. Am I a patient? I don't know because I'm not a doctor. I know that I'm not a doctor. And so people should make the choice for themselves.
So you,
God, you're impossible. Jesus Christ, man. You know, so you think everybody, you want the government demanding that everybody gets a vaccine, right?
I'm pretty close to that. I mean, I think it would probably be more like, if you want to participate in certain things in society, I would be okay with people requiring.
Mm-hmm. And where does it stop? So first the government is knocking on my door and it's like, it's very innocent. Hey, did you, get a vaccine? We're just asking. It's just the Biden administration trying to find out if you've had a vaccine. Very innocent, right? And you go, no, I haven't had a vaccine. Oh, okay. We're going to write this down. And you know what? Here's a vaccine. I don't want a vaccine. Here's the chip. I mean, the vaccine.
What's the chip? Huh? What did you say? The chip?
I meant the vaccine. And then, so, you know, now the Biden administration, they innocently give you a shot. They knock on your door. And then what is to stop them from coming back a week later and saying, hey, do you watch gay porn? And I say, no. Well, here. And then they quickly, like, they open up their phone or their iPad, and suddenly I'm looking at gay porn, and they're converting me.
Converting you?
To be a homosexual. Converting me. Because it starts with, hey, come on, did you get a vaccine? We're looking out for you. And the next thing you know, you can't take your eyes off gay porn. You want that? You want that for your country?
Well,
maybe you do.
I mean, you sound very Tucker Carlson at that moment, but I have to
thank
say,
you.
David.
Thank you. I just saw Jimmy Dore on Tucker, and I think it's great that Tucker's having Jimmy Dore on. It shows that he's open to all sides of the argument, getting the brightest, the best from the left on. I would give anything to be on Tucker Carlson to support him. And give credence to Tucker Carlson. That's what everybody on the left should be doing.
Well, we actually do have
on Tucker Carlson.
We have that clip.
Can I just ask quickly, should he have mentioned the march on Tucker? Because I don't think he did.
Yeah, no mention of the Medicare for All march, Feldman. What do you think? Why was Jimmy there if he wasn't going to promote Medicare for All?
Because he cares so much about Medicare for All,
right?
That he, if he were to bring it up, it would have been, you know, rude to Tucker Carlson. You're a guest on his show, so you say the things your guest wants you to say.
Well, let's play that clip. This is Jimmy Dore on Tucker Carlson on Tucker Carlson's Today Show. And this is Jimmy explaining the dynamic as to why folks like AOC are sellouts, because they're afraid of a challenge from the left.
So what I'm trying to tell people is
why?
That when you vote for them, when you vote for somebody inside the Democratic Party, no matter what they say, no matter what they believe, they're going to go along with Nancy Pelosi. And Nancy Pelosi goes along with Goldman Sachs and Raytheon. So when you're voting for someone inside the Democratic Party, you're voting for Goldman Sachs and Raytheon because they are not standing up to those people. So the idea that we have progressives inside the Democratic Party, it's actually more deleterious to the progressive movement to have them there. Why is that, Jimmy? Because it gives people a false impression that there's somebody in government fighting for you, that there's one of the parties that are kind of on your side, and they aren't. And the quicker people realize that both parties are not on their side, they only serve the oligarchy. We are, in fact, in an oligarchy. Your democracy was stolen way before Trump. Until that happens, we won't ever have real change.
But what about Ocasio-Cortez? She's so on Instagram.
Wise. That is so wise.
Ocasio-Cortez.
So wise.
Well, hold on.
I've never heard that.
Go back.
He used the word so wise. It is so wise. Deleterious. He almost pronounced that properly. The way I think you come across as smart, Sam, is you steamroll something you've memorized and don't leave any room for questioning. That's how you...
Well, I mean, to be fair, now wait a second. You interrupted here because Tucker did question Jimmy. So let's listen to that question.
Okay.
Well, what about Ocasio-Cortez? She's on Instagram.
Ocasio-Cortez campaigned on a floor vote on Medicare for All. And she campaigned on creating what she called a ruckus, meaning you have to stop being polite. This is a quote. You have to stop being polite. We tried being polite, and it got us nowhere. And it wasn't until we started acting out and speaking impolitely that we even created the circumstances for change. That's what she tweeted. So I'm just doing what she said. So I started to put heat on people like AOC and Rashid Tlaib and Ro Khanna and all the Justice Democrats and the squad to force the vote. And they said I was committing violence against them with my words. That's how scared they got.
They did not.
Were you?
That's how scared. You really telling them to do what they ran on? That's violence. That's how afraid they were. And all the things. So they had people write hit pieces on me in the Daily New York Magazine, Newsweek, BuzzFeed. They tried to shut me down and squelch me. They made me trend on Twitter negatively. They couldn't shut me up. And they couldn't stop me. And they don't know what to do with me. Because, again, all the usual. They have Wikipedia putting smears on me that I can't get rid of. CNN's calling me. It's unbelievable what's going on. Just a comedian, a pothead comedian in his garage. What you can do when you want to tell the truth inside journalism and politics. And you can create a ruckus. And I did. And so now everybody sees that those people are fakers. And they're corrupt.
Fantastic.
And the reason why I say they're corrupt is not because they take corporate money and do the bidding of corporations.
Yeah, go ahead.
This is the height of intellectualism. When you say, I'm just a comedian. I'm just a moron. I'm just a D's, Dems, and Does guy. That's convincing to me. How is it that I'm a fucking idiot, but I'm getting it right? Even though I'm a fucking idiot. That's brilliant.
Well,
I salute him. That is such a great rhetorical device. I'm a fucking stupid comic. I'm a moron. I don't read. You know, I don't know anything. How come
I know for a
I'm
fact
so
he doesn't
smart?
Read.
Well, you know, to be fair, he's probably convinced a lot of Tucker Carlson's viewers that AOC isn't the person that she says she is. That's probably he's probably been able to sort of like bring people around on AOC who watch Tucker Carlson. But continue, Eric, because he's got a very interesting theory. He makes it clear.
Here's the thing that you don't understand. Before you play this brilliant mind, this well-read policy nerd, because that's what he is. Before you play that, what you fail to understand is focus. Jimmy understands focus. You're all over the map. Jimmy has isolated who the enemy is, AOC. AOC, and that is so wise on his part to focus on the most powerful person in Washington, D.C., who she could wake up tomorrow, AOC, and decide, you know what? I do want Medicare for All, and I want it yesterday. And she can go do that. That's how powerful she is. He knows who the oligarchs are. He used the term oligarchs. He knows that only a few people control politics in Washington, D.C. He knows who unlike you, he knows who the power players are. The squad. You don't see that the squad is the most powerful. They're like the Trilateral Commission and the Bilderberg Group into one. We need to hammer AOC and Pramila Jayapal every single day. And the fact that they're women of color, that's irrelevant. Well, we need to hammer the squad,
to
Sam.
Be fair, he also
they
said Ro Khanna.
You know that women of color, or Ro Khanna of color, they are the most powerful people in Washington, D.C. Jimmy's going after the oligarchs.
Yeah. Hey, David, is this...
And the squad, they're the most powerful people. Well, okay. They're the only thing that's keeping us from Medicare for all.
Yes. Let's hear Jimmy's explanation of their corruption. It is not the corporate corruption that the Justice Democrats have. Go back a little bit. This is an important point I think he's trying to make here.
Couldn't shut me up, and they couldn't stop me, and they don't know what to do with me because, again, all the usual. They have Wikipedia.
Pause
putting
it. Hold
smears
on one second. Since we're here, David, when he says they don't know what to do with me, like do they need to do something with him?
Don't you wake up every morning and say, "What are we going to do about Jimmy Dore?"
I mean, I
that's
do.
That's the whole.
Of course, but I mean,
haven't you been following?
Well, we don't.
What's
we
been
don't
going
need
on
to.
With the young Turks?
Well,
I haven't been following that as much as I probably
you
should.
You don't wake up every morning. You haven't donated hours of your air. My 16 hour. I spent 16 hours a day talking about Kyle Kulinski's tepid response to Jimmy's attack on Cenk Uygur, because we can't have Medicare for all until we resolve this dispute between the Young Turks and Jimmy.
Okay.
And no. You don't understand that.
Okay, but
I want Medicare for all, but we can't have Medicare for
who
all
is the
until we destroy AOC and the Young Turks.
Do. Who is the they that doesn't know what to do with Jimmy? Is it the Young Turks don't know what to do with Jimmy, or the people?
All of us.
Okay.
All of us.
He's that powerful.
Right, let's play. Let's continue to play.
Me that I can't get rid of. CNN's calling me. It's unbelievable what's going on. Just a comedian, a pothead comedian in his garage. What you can do when you want to tell the truth inside journalism and politics, and you can create a ruckus. And I did. And so now everybody sees that those people are fakers and they're corrupt. And the reason why I say they're corrupt is not because they take corporate money and do the bidding of corporations, but they're doing the bidding of their own career. Right. Their own self-dealing.
Yeah.
So if I go along with the establishment, I'm going to get a book deal. I'm going to get speaking fees and I'm going to be in Congress for at least 5 years and then I get a pension for the rest of my life. That is corrupt. And that's why they're not pushing back, because Nancy Pelosi could come in and crush you. Hey, we'll fund somebody in a primary to your left, just like she did to Joe Crowley, AOC. Right. So that's what they're all afraid of. They're afraid of the power of the establishment taking away what little power and that they have in Congress.
Now, yes, David, AOC. Pelosi
that's
is
pretty
funding.
Wise stuff yeah. coming from a guy in his garage who's got the door shut and the engine running, suffering from carbon monoxide poisoning. I mean, that's pretty wise stuff.
Is Nancy Pelosi
a real truth teller?
Nancy
a guy
Pelosi
in his garage smoking pot with the door shut and the engine running.
How many times has Nancy
that's pretty
Pelosi,
smart stuff,
David? How many times has Nancy Pelosi mounted a challenge to an incumbent from their left?
What did Crowley do to make her fund AOC?
Crowley? Did he say Crowley was
a
lefty?
I think the idea
he was trying
to
say that AOC primaried Crowley from the left, and that the next that's going to happen to her, but Pelosi's going to be the one funding the leftist challenger.
So wait a second, should we be rooting for Pelosi?
So it would be a false flag operation.
Wait,
yeah,
that
should
would
be
a false
rooting
flag operation.
For Pelosi?
Is he selling boner pills? Does he sell boner pills too?
Should we be rooting for Pelosi to fund left challenges to the leftmost? I mean, I'm sort of in favor of that.
Yeah, let's, I hope Pelosi does that.
Yeah, base
that
Pelosi.
Good. But now, David, I think you know, probably because you are in show business and have had wild success as a show business person, that
you're
if
welcome.
AOC...
You're welcome.
If yes,
I just want to say you're welcome for all that I've given.
There's been a lot of things, I'm sure, that you have been peripherally involved in that I've enjoyed.
Yes, your show of shows... The Eddie Cantor show.
Right. I remember it. I saw it at a museum once. But listen, AOC would, if
yes,
she
the most powerful person in the world, yes,
if she were to lose her seat, she'd never get a book deal, right? She would never,
no,
she would
no.
not, she would have a tough time making money. She'd probably have to go back to bartending. Is that your sense?
If Jimmy says that, I think it's true.
Well, David,
I trust the D's and Dems guy who's never read a book in his life and has to hire writers and smokes dope and attacks women of color.
And maybe some
I
other
trust
things.
That guy.
David, why do you think that he didn't mention Medicare for All in this segment in studio on Tucker's daytime program, or really the Republican Party for all we know?
Emma. Have you ever heard of three-dimensional chess?
I do. I remember it.
Have you?
I remember it from being discussed many times, but in the Obama administration.
Jimmy Dore is playing three-dimensional diarrhea.
Is that a game?
This is way beyond. Yeah, it's way beyond. It's a level of politics beyond your grasp.
Can I try
three-dimensional diarrhea?
Just to elucidate this, David, because I'm interested in your understanding of this.
What is two-dimensional diarrhea?
Well, three-dimensional diarrhea. That's what Jimmy's playing.
David, are you familiar with the Nina Turner race and how Hillary has endorsed her opponent? Do you think that, you know, the right way to get Medicare for All is to oppose Nina Turner and vote against her?
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing you, in all seriousness.
I'm asking, should we oppose Nina Turner so the squad doesn't get more powerful as a way to get Medicare for All faster?
I think that Nina Turner is a threat to democracy. And it's too soon. It's too soon.
David, this has been really enlightening. I am a little surprised with some of the positions that you're taking on things, but that is one of the things why people, I think, tune into your show, the David Feldman Show. It's because you're
right.
Sometimes a little bit unpredictable.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, again, I donated to Michael Brooks' Legacy Project.
Anonymously.
Anonymously.
It was very big of you to do that in an anonymous fashion so that no one would know that
and
you donated.
It was a big donation.
Part of it was a mistake. Though,
it was a mistake. It was a mistake. I accidentally added a zero. And it's not bothering me at all. It's like, you know what? Who cares, right? I added an extra zero. Who cares? Let it go. I'm not even thinking about it.
Are you going to try and get your money back?
No, not at all. What? Money back from what? I've already forgotten about over-donating, accidentally donating too much to the Michael Brooks Legacy Project at patreon.com/TMBS. I'm not even thinking about the fact that they probably, I mean, you would think. I know we have to wrap it up.
We do.
I don't really care. I just find this curious. You would think that the people over at the Michael Brooks Legacy Project would have seen my donation and maybe double check to see if that was what I really wanted to donate, because it was so obviously a mistake. I mean, who gives that kind of money? You know,
certainly not.
You would think that somebody would have seen the extra zero and would have raised a red flag over at the Michael Brooks Legacy Project. And I would have received a phone call double checking. Hey, Mr. Feldman, we noticed you're in Winfield, Connecticut next month opening for Bobby Collins at the Peace Spot. And we also noticed an extra zero. We noticed you donated $10 instead of one. Is that extra zero a mistake? That's all. It was just a call.
Wait, $10?
Not an extra zero.
Hey, you brought that up, not me. And I donate just to donate. I don't need to. Hey, David Feldman, what a magnanimous gesture. No, that's tacky, Sam, to bring that up.
Well, that's not the way I was raised, but we've already been through that. David, as always, a real pleasure talking to you.
You think that I don't care. I really don't care, Emma. I really don't care. They could have double checked with me. I'm not a mathematician, But
you're not,
there is an exponential,
correct. You
there's
are
an
not
exponential
mapping.
Lurch. Sam, there's an exponential
David
lurch
Feldman
from $1 to
$10.
And you would
thank
think
you so
someone
today.
Would
really
have called me
it.
And said,
David, thank
you think somebody would have said, David Feldman, host of the
David,
unofficial armchair
so
expert Dax Shepard post-game
you.
Wrap-up.
Thank you.
Where you
thank
review
you.
All those amazing
thank
things
you.
Dax Shepard says. Hey, David Feldman, are you sure about this? Are you sure you want to donate this much? You would.
Yeah, we had to let him go. Sorry about that, folks. That was
what was the David? What was the Dax Shepard post game wrap up?
I have no idea what was going on with that, any of that.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somewhere I lost my drive, between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. The months shifted into you, while I shifted in and out.